Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail. I directed that our surveillance be stepped up.
If you seek peace, Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Hi, geeks. My name is Nick, and you're listening to the special Halloween edition of the Geeked on History podcast, coming to you live from the recording closet of doom. One of my favorite things to do when my wife and I are visiting a new city that we've never been to is to find the most comprehensive walking ghost tour that we can. It's a personally held belief of mine that walking around a city is really the best way to understand how the city works, especially if you're not from that area. If you really want to understand the way that people live in a big city, you usually have to do what they do, and oftentimes in these big cities you end up having to walk around. Sometimes it's not practical to have a car. But this way you get a full appreciation of the things and places that people see every day on their way to work or home or wherever they're going. A lot of times the pace of life in a big city is so fast that people going from place to place who even live in these areas don't even realize that they're walking right by one of the biggest historical places in the entire city. And while there are plenty of, like, touristy little tours that you can do that don't involve, it's my opinion that the best history is to do a ghost, because that's all that ghost stories really are. Some ghost tours even have says that they can get you into certain places that you wouldn't even necessarily see if you live. Sometimes they can get you behind locked doors or into basements that people normally aren't allowed in. Not all ghost tours are like this, but if you can find one like that, you're bound to something really interesting. The trouble with ghost stories is that a lot of times the fiction becomes more important than the facts. So for this week's podcast, I decided to do something a little bit different. Sure, I could tell you, and there's a good chance that I could hit on something historic that you may not have known before, but I think that the best way to tell a ghost story is to do the research and find out what's true and what's not true. So that's what we're going to do today. So put on your best walking shoes and let's go on a little ghost tour through history. A few years ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to go visit our friends from down under in the Australian continent. While I was there, I was able to visit probably one of the top three cities in the Southern Hemisphere. Sydney, Australia. Sydney is a beautiful city. If you've ever seen it, then you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. The harbor is beautiful, and for a city that's really comparatively not that old, it's got a ton of history built in. This little story is a shout-out, by the way, to my Australian fans who've already emailed into me, and we've had some conversations. So, hi in Australia. I hope you guys appreciate this one. I'm thinking about you. But what some people don't know is that Sydney is a city built on top of history, literally and figuratively. I think if you ask most people about Australian history, they're probably going to say something about the penal colonies. I would argue that Sydney's Botany Bay is probably one of the most famous penal colonies in history. And as with any big city, there are parts of the city that are older than others. In fact, one of my favorite parts of Sydney is one of the oldest. It's a place called The Rocks, and it's a little part of the city that's right underneath the Sydney Harbour Bridge on the south side of the harbour. The Rocks is this really upscale area with a lot of really high-end shops, very high-priced hotels. If you're looking for Australian opal, there's shops all over the place that you can buy it in The Rocks. But there's this very interesting juxtaposition between the way that The Rocks was before gentrification and what it is today. Because, you see, if you had been in The Rocks before the whole gentrification period a few decades ago, you would have been standing in a really nasty slum. At the turn of the century, you could have found anything that you wanted to, from gangs to prostitutes. So it really goes without saying that it was a favorite spot amongst the sailors who would come into port. And if you look close enough at this part of the city, you're going to see evidence of the slum that was there before. If you take a trip down to Playfair Street, you're going to find a lot of the same upscale restaurants and shops that you're bound to find almost anywhere else in The Rocks. But if you manage to find your way around the storefronts, you'll find one of the favorite local drinking hangouts. It's called Foundation Park. Foundation Park is a dream for guys like me who like to tour around and see history, especially hidden history, places that are difficult to find. You see, because Foundation Park is actually about 25 to 30 feet up on a sheer cliff, just behind the storefronts. They call it Foundation Park because what you're going to find there are the foundations of 8 houses that were built between 1874 and 1878. Now, I have to tell you, Foundation Park is a pretty creepy place, especially at night, because really what you're standing in are the foundations of people's houses that were there before but were torn down. So literally what you're going to see are these very low-lying brick walls that are very clear segments. I mean, these were people's rooms at one point. These were where people carried their business, lived their lives. And what the city has done with these places is they put this giant iron furniture inside of certain rooms so that people can go and kind of hang out there. It's a very cool little spot, but like I said, pretty creepy. If you want to see pictures, there's actually a photo on Google Street View that you can find if you search for Sydney Foundation Park. So give it a look and see what you think. While there are ghost stories about Foundation Park, they're a little bit vague, but mainly they have to do with people falling off the cliff and dying as a result of drinking too much and not really paying attention. But Foundation Park is creepy for a different reason. As I said before, this part of the city was a place that was very low income. It was a slummy area, not a place where upscale people would travel. All cities have a part of the city that's like this. And usually, especially around the turn of the century, what you find in areas like this is a lot of disease. People living in close quarters and tenements and things like that is a perfect breeding ground for disease. And the Rocks was a perfect example of this. At the turn of the century, there was a noteworthy outbreak of plague that occurred in Sydney. The first victim was a dock worker named Arthur Payne. Mr. Payne lived right up the road from possibly the oldest pub on the Australian continent, a pub called the Hero of Waterloo on Lower Fort Street, just a few short blocks away from Foundation Park. And now as the plague swept across the entire city, people began to die from it. And at the time of this recording, there's a pretty big Ebola outbreak going on in the world. So you can kind of imagine the hysteria that's going on with Ebola, but apply that to a major city, and only a major city. Imagine how hysterical people would be if they knew that there was some contagious disease going around. It'd be a little bit like a zombie movie, am I right? I certainly get that same kind of guttural feeling whenever somebody is sick in the house, like that feeling like, I'm next, you know? That looming, creepy feeling you get when you know you're going to be sick. And so back then, you know, they would do the same sort of things that we would do today. They would quarantine people with plague, and if and when they died, they would have to decontaminate their living spaces. Oftentimes that meant just demolishing the house. And so that's where we get to Foundation Park. Foundation Park is an example of what happens when a big city gets sick, around 1900. Now, for full disclosure, the houses weren't really torn down until the 1930s. But these particular houses were torn down as a result of numerous plague outbreaks, 12 to be exact, between 1900 and 1925. And so there we have the inherent creepy factor of Foundation Park. When you go to drink in Foundation Park, you're drinking in the houses of people who probably died of plague. So if you're living in Sydney and you're looking for a more macabre drinking experience, I highly recommend Foundation Park. Now, another place that was touched by the Sydney plague that has a lot more ghost stories to it is a place called the North Head Quarantine Station, which sits just there at the northeastern tip of the mouth of the harbor in Manly. The North Head Quarantine Station was ground zero for all kinds of contagious diseases that spread around the world during the 1800s and 1900s. People visiting the quarantine station claim to have been pushed down on a regular basis by unseen forces that are supposedly related to the droves of deaths at the site over the centuries. Cholera, smallpox, Spanish flu, bubonic plague, all of these ailments were seen and treated at quarantine station, but more often than not, those afflicted did not leave the station alive. Quarantine Station was convenient geographically because it was in a good place to screen incoming vessels that were trying to get into Sydney Harbor. If an incoming ship had infected people on board, they would be required to quarantine all of those aboard before they would be given the okay to make port in the city. During peak times, there may be up to 8 ships anchored just outside the harbor, waiting for the clearance to go ahead and go into the harbor. In fact, Quarantine Station saw so many deaths that the captain of one quarantine ship called the Beagle a Captain Stokes, said that he could tell the location of Quarantine Station by the white tombstones lining the side of the hill on the harbor side. So in the end, the numbers that I could find on the New South Wales website were a little bit unclear, but the plague apparently killed up to 1,300 people across New South Wales and Queensland over that 25-year period. If you're a believer in the supernatural, that's a lot of potential ghost stories. The next ghost story is from a place that most people have probably heard is haunted. It sits anchored in Long Beach, California, and claimed the Spruce Goose as its next-door neighbor for a number of years. The Queen Mary is one of the most famous ships of this bygone era of steam cruise liners. The most famous is probably the Titanic, but the Queen Mary is another one of these that got a lot of attention back in its day. It seemed like every new ship to be built and put to sea was designed to do one up on the competition with the most cutting-edge amenities and accommodations, but safety wasn't always a primary consideration during construction. Over the years, tons and tons of people have gone in to investigate this creaky old ship to find evidence for some of the 150 ghosts that are claimed to be living on the ship. But the engine room is said to be one of the most haunted locations on the entire ship. The stories of this ghost center on a door, a watertight door called door number 13. And the story goes that an 18-year-old crew member who was crushed to death by the massive iron sliding bulkhead door in 1966 during one of the last sea voyages of the ship is now a ghost in this very area. Ghost investigators believe this to be the ghost of a guy named John Petter. Now, the interesting thing about this is that John Petter actually was a real crew member. He was 18, and he actually was killed on board in 1966 by this massive sliding door. So all of that is true. And part of the evidence for this is actually a plaque that lists all the casualties on the ship that is on the ship. The year it happened, the name of the victim, and the cause of death. I'm going to put a picture of what this plaque looks like up on geekdownhistory.com, so if you'd like to see it, I really encourage you to check it out. Now, the plaque is a compiled list from the archives of the ship. And it is true that during World War II, the ship saw a lot of casualties because it operated as a troop transport and medical ship. And the Queen Mary is just an amazing ship. It's an example of this era that we don't see anymore. This time where we had artisanship and all kinds of different things that seemed mundane to people, but it just had that kind of pomp and circumstance built into it when it was constructed. Everything from the Art Deco halls and pools to the staterooms all were brilliantly ornate. And it's just the most perfect example of they don't make them like they used to, that I could ever think of. Now, another story that you hear a lot of, if you listen to any of these ghost stories about the Queen Mary, are about two little girls that are supposedly named Dana and Penny, who were murdered by their father in room B474 in 1959. As the story goes, their father murdered his daughters and wife by strangulation before shooting himself. And now the two little girls spend all of their time in the first-class pool, a place that's been called a vortex by psychics who have gone through and investigated the ship. This story was significantly more difficult to find any evidence for. From my research, I wasn't actually even able to find any confirmations about the so-called murder on the ship. It's very possible that the story exists in an archive somewhere for the Queen Mary, but since the archive isn't searchable yet, I wasn't actually able to find anything that pointed to this as being a true story, with some historical context that I can give you in order to help corroborate some of the facts. I honestly couldn't even find the last names of the little girls or the father, but this story to me really illustrates what you have to do, whether you're a historian or an amateur historian. There are certain things that you're going to have to decide whether you're going to take on faith or if you're actually going to insist on evidence for. Now, you all know me. I'm a very evidence-based guy. So if any of you listeners have heard anything about this story and you have some record that you'd like to share with me, I really encourage you to do that. I'd love to see it. You can email me at nick@geekdownhistory.com. Now for the last story, I want to bring it back a little bit closer to where I live. And the reason that I love where I live so much is because of the amount of history that I have access to. I'm within an hour's drive of some of the most rich historic sites in the entire American history catalog. The final ghost story that I want to share with you is a local ghost story from Maryland. It's a story about a house and a family carrying a terrible shame that would echo through generations. The story you're about to hear is a very famous local legend that most people in the city of Annapolis are familiar with. If you ask any native to tell you about the crying girl of Bryce House, they'll probably be able to tell you. Now, Annapolis itself is a city with a very old history. It reaches far back into the U.S. colonies, with sinews linking all the major names in the American Revolution to various sites around the city. A lot of times people will compare Annapolis to the city of Williamsburg, Virginia, if you've ever been there. It's a living city with a very rich history, except the difference is that people in Annapolis don't really have the same urge to put on historic garb and walk around the city. But it is just as historic, and it's a lot less touristy. Middleton's Tavern, for instance, is an inn that housed many of the American forefathers on their journey from Maryland's eastern shore. As you might expect, Middleton's has its own menu of ghost stories to go along with the history. Now, Middleton's Tavern is somewhat tame. You'll usually hear stories about glasses being pushed off the bar, people's shirts being tugged. Every once in a while, someone will report seeing what they call a full-bodied apparition, but nothing quite as sinister as the story that you're about to hear. You see, the Bryce House is a large colonial-style house that isn't unlike a lot of the other houses in Annapolis. It was completed by a man named James Bryce somewhere between 1767 and 1775. The ghost stories of the Bryce House aren't just limited to a single ghost. The stories claim that there were a number of people that died in the house over the years, and in some way or another, most of these people haunt the house today. One of the most famous being the Crying Girl. Over the last couple decades, people have supposedly been reporting cries coming from inside the Bryce House. The cries are so loud and frightening that oftentimes the people that have reported these have called the police to come investigate to find out exactly what's going on. And when the police come, they don't find any girl crying anywhere in the area. This has caused the ghost investigators that have gone to check the site out to look into the history and see if they can find anything. So let's get back to James Bryce. James Bryce was the governor of Maryland, actually, for 1 year in 1792 when the elected governor's health, that was Governor George Plater, began to fail. James Bryce was a lawyer and a landowner, and in his day he was able to stake claim to one of the largest landholdings on the entire East Coast. He was a very well-respected man with what seemed like the perfect family. He took a wife named Julia Jennings in 1781, and they had 6 kids together. Local legend says that there was a 7th child, a daughter, who was born mentally disturbed. And as a way of avoiding embarrassment, they kept her somewhere in the house. Since the story of the crying girl of Bryce House has been around, people have been talking about how this 7th child was probably abused and kept somewhere in the house. Probably was underfed. Maybe beaten. Nobody quite knows for sure. But what people are sure about is that the cries coming from the Bryce House have something to do with its turbulent history. Now, the claims of the people who supported the story of the crying girl seem to have been confirmed when they claim a body was found behind a false wall in the basement, a skeletal body of a young girl who probably died 100 years before the body was found. And when they removed that wall, they actually found scratch marks on the wall, which indicate that this young girl was put in there alive. Again, speculation claims that she was probably malnourished and that's how she died there. But once the body was found and given a proper Christian burial, the crying stopped and hasn't been heard since. And that's the story of the Bryce House Crying Girl. Now, I'm a guy who likes a good ghost story just as much as the next guy. But as we already said, I have to have the evidence. So I did a little bit of research on the Crying Girl. And this is another story that I had a lot of difficulty finding the facts on. I wasn't able to find any news stories about any body being found in the basement. There was no false wall, and I actually had a difficult time finding people that had claimed to have even heard the crying girl in person. So all that I was able to find of this story are the local legends. All second and third hand stories. But what makes the story of the Bryce House a lot more interesting is the facts that were added in later as part of the story. And these are true facts. A number of years ago, the Bryce House was actually sold to a group called the Annapolis Bricklayers Union. Their intention was to renovate the house and turn it into a museum for the history of the Bricklayers Union. And that's true. The house actually has been under renovation for a number of years, but it hasn't yet opened as a museum. The stories claim that the reason that it hasn't opened as a museum is because of all the hauntings that have taken place inside the house. And the one piece of the story that I was alluding to before was what was found in the kitchen. If you point your browser to ala.umd.edu/bryce.html, you'll find a website that outlines exactly what was found in the kitchen. Now, during renovations in 1998, under a loose brick in the kitchen, renovators found what the University of Maryland calls a wide but shallow collection of hoodoo artifacts. I've seen this discovery called the Annapolis Hoodoo Cache a number of times. But what we know about it is that these were a collection of 100 meticulously placed hoodoo artifacts all throughout the kitchen area. As it turns out, this is an archaeological gold mine. But to understand why, we have to understand a little bit about what hoodoo is. Now that's hoodoo, not to be confused with voodoo. These are two very different things. You see, hoodoo is more of a personal belief system. It's the belief that there is a certain magic that you can perform with common items. It is not a religion. It's a tertiary belief system that you can actually have a normal organized religion and still be able to practice hoodoo. You can still be a Protestant Christian and practice hoodoo. These things are not mutually exclusive. If you're a practitioner of voodoo, however, there's a number of gods and goddesses that all play into that faith. That certainly is a faith-based religion, and it is mutually exclusive to other religions. You can't be Christian or Catholic and be voodoo at the same time. It's one or the other. Now, hoodoo and hoodoo artifacts are really important to historians because what it does is it gives you a little glimpse into the people that were practicing it at that time. And the people who were practicing hoodoo at that time were mainly African Americans. They were usually slaves or servants. Today, historians believe that hoodoo gave these African slaves and servants a way to escape racism. It was a way for them to feel like they were more in control of their fate, even though they weren't really able to make free choices on their own. And when archaeologists make a find like this, it really gives them a good idea of what these African American slaves and servants felt was important in their lives. It was a major part of their culture, their individual culture. And culture is ultimately what ghost stories are all about. It's one of the few oral traditions that we still have today. Certainly one of the few that people will actually pay to participate in. Now, the ghost stories have included this archaeological find as part of the story now. It's not that this find was interesting in its own historical way. The storytellers will hint that this find was there because of the hauntings that were pre-existing, that these people were dealing with the same kinds of hauntings that people today deal with. But if you can get past the ghost stories, what you really see here is the evolution of oral tradition, that in some way, there really is a grain of truth to the story. Even if it's not supernatural, there's always something that plays in that really did happen. And in my opinion, that's what makes ghost stories so fun. If you're willing to dig into the past and confirm some of the things that you hear in a ghost story, you're bound to learn something really interesting. And if it's a local legend, like the crying girl of the Bryce House, you're also sure to learn something new about the very city that you live in. All you have to do is be willing to do a little bit of research on your own. Hey everybody, thanks for listening to this spooky edition of the Geeked on History podcast. Do you have any ghost stories of your own? Do you have any details about some of the ghost stories that we talked about today? Send them on in to me at nick@geekedonhistory.com. I hope you have a happy and fun Halloween this year, and I really hope that you enjoyed the show. And don't forget to visit the blog at geekedonhistory.com. Geeked on History is a 100% listener-supported podcast. So if you like what you hear and you want to help support the show, follow the donation links on the left-hand side of the blog. If donating isn't quite your speed, it always helps to see ratings and reviews on our pages on iTunes and Stitcher. It only takes a minute, and it makes all the difference for us to see good reviews. Thanks again for listening to this week's podcast, and stay spooky.